the larger table about what really matters. And so I think that just like Reverend Jen was talking about in terms of bringing people together on a common agenda and then figuring out how to take on the harder issues that divide us to see if we can then find common ground is a way of doing it. It's a way that we do it in our union. We've had forums in our union about gay marriage with people having strong opinions on both sides, getting to a better place at the end. Maybe not to the same place, but to a better place. On the issue of immigration, you know, we've had, it's an issue that's been dividing people across our country. We've had great forums in our unions where people from different backgrounds have told their stories and talk about what the debate right now means to them, and it has changed people's minds. And so I think that by bringing people together, having an understanding that we can do things together that we can't do alone, and actually delivering on that, gives us an opportunity to have a much deeper conversation about the issues that divide us, and I think that that can change things.
There's nothing like a cross-pressured voter to bring out creative thinking on the part of politicians. I was once told, and this is a story too good to check in that category, of a union leader in Pennsylvania, many of whose members were also union members who were members of the NRA, and he got in front of one of his union crowds and said, at least under the Democrats, you can afford ammunition. And they went about 65% for Gore. So, Bruce, you wanted to come in on that.
Two things, EJ. First, I think all of us who champion rights have to recognize the duties that we owe to one another, and that the future of expanding individual rights is expanding individual responsibilities. That's what Neil was getting at earlier. They're not at odds with one another. One is a necessary ingredient to enable the others. The second is that we need a politics of national purpose and responsibility, and I think there's an enormous temptation on the progressive side to watch the smash-mouth politics that goes on the conservative side and try to emulate it. I mean, we see, you know, 2 weeks ago, after the Foley scandal broke, four Republican congressmen announced that they wanted to investigate Sandy Berger for walking out of the National Archives with some papers, which just showed that Republicans were more interested in the pages in Berger's pants than their members in Page's pants, but
he always does this, you know.
But it's important that we recognize that, you know, most Americans are Americans first. The reason that the common good appeals to them is not that's a reason to pull the progressive lever over the other lever. It's that we're only going to get go forward as individuals if we can go forward as a country.
Let me just one more question on that front, which is 10 years ago I wrote a book called They Only Look Dead: Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era, which I don't laugh. I think it's help is on the way. But there was a there was a review of that book by a kind of multicultural person who resented the fact that in a book which was broadly speaking progressive, I used the word family repeatedly instead of individual. And this somehow made me potentially sexist or heterosexist, which I like to think I'm not. And of course, I don't harbor any resentment, even though I remember that review 10 years later. But, you know, it did actually sort of cause me to sort of do some thinking about this, and that it seems to me among progressives there often is a reluctance, say on a question, to think of some collectivity, particularly the family. And yet I would make a case that one can be strongly in favor of gay and lesbian rights and still believe in the profound importance of the family as a social building block, and that there is an obligation on the part of progressives to strengthen family life. Does anybody want to take that on, including agree with the reviewer if you wish, though I might walk off the stage, but go ahead.
I just really resonate with that. I think the first way people learn about the common good and learn about community is through the personal experience and the family. And I think, you know, for Catholics, the common good is deep within their tradition, and they're taught about it growing up, hopefully. But also for evangelicals, I think one of the entry points for them to understand the common good is through the family, and that we've given far too much ground up on this issue of family. There's so many progressive values that can be encapsulated in talking about how to create families that can support themselves and can flourish. So I think we need to reclaim that language.
Please.
just want to throw in one point. It's a little awkward because I know we're talking about the debate within the United States, but the whole world is watching this, and I've spent more of my adult life outside the United States than in it. And I think what people are seeing is an America that has become about the other, whether it's a rejection of people on the basis of their sexual preference, whether it's building walls so that Mexicans won't get into the United States, whether it is vilifying Arabs. I think the Chinese are scheduled to come up soon. There is a projection of this debate onto the world stage. It's the internet, it's because we're America. But people everywhere are watching. I go to rural villages in Africa and people know what we're talking about. And I think we've got to be mindful that one of the things the common good can give us is a way to have a different discussion at home and project a different discussion abroad. Because the conclusions that are being drawn and the policies that are being emulated are going to come back to haunt us if we don't. So I think there's a real driver from the outside that we need to bear in mind in this also.
Tom, did you want to come in on this, or Professor Katyal?
I keep reflecting. Have you ever played the game of life?
Yes.
That board game? I played it recently. I have a seven and a four-year-old. And it's sort of a perverse game. Whoever has the most money wins the game of life. But putting that aside for the moment, you get about a quarter of the way through, and you have to stop and get married. And there's the car, and there's the blue for the male and the pink for the female. And what's wonderful about this game, and the reason I love playing it with my kids, is we always have a discussion with my girls when we get married about, they get in their pink car with their pink, and then they discuss, okay, I'm getting married. Do I put a pink or a blue next to me? And sometimes they put pink, and sometimes they put blue, because they have many friends who are in single parent families. They have many friends who have two moms. They have friends who have two dads. And it's a really interesting conception. And I'm always, it brings a smile to my face when we talk about this issue of family. And I know, I'm not sure I'm on point here, but I love, that's the only aspect of the game of life that I like. And I think if we can,
Now there's one you could take out of context.
Yes. But I think they've embodied the common good there in the sense that they understand that there are many different ways to build family. So that's your response perhaps to your critique.
By the way, some of you may also remember a game called Careers, where you could pick either some combination of love, fame, and money. And as a kid, I figured out that it appeared the rules were tilted toward love. So in a greedy, opportunistic way, I would tilt my little scorecard toward love. But, Anna.
But in the reality of life, as opposed to the game of life, the best indicator of what your economic standing will be as an adult is what the economic standing of your parents were. That's pretty depressing. If you're poor, you're going to be poor. If you're rich, you're going to be rich. And that is and the problem, I would just say, in talking about families, people work hard every day. Families work hard. We have more wage earners in every household than ever before. People work two or three jobs, and they worry about how to get their kids to or from school in between those two or three jobs. They worry about whether they can afford bus fare or breakfast. They worry about health care and housing. They worry about those economic things. And I think that when we talk about the common good and raising up families, it's a family value. It's talking about how do working families survive? How do working families have parents have enough time for their kids so they can go to parent-teacher meetings or help them with the homework? It's all of that. I believe strongly, not in talking about individual rights. I'm strongly talking about families and how to strengthen our families and how to strengthen our communities, because it is about how we work together to be able to raise up our communities. And I agree with Gail about the addressing the issues on a global front. We have to talk about working families around our globe. And the truth is, I can understand totally why people in other parts of the world worry about what's going on in our country. Not only do they hear the debate of us pitted against each other in our own country and trying to keep people out of our country, we also see what global corporations who have our name, U.S. companies' names on them, doing when they travel around the world and when they land in countries. We need to do something about global trade. Global, the world is global. trade is global, but we need to figure out a way of taking workers' rights around the world and capital rights and getting them closer together. Right now, we have freed capital to do anything in the world that they want. They can pollute our society, they can pollute our communities, they can step on workers' rights. Right now in China is having a debate about opening up the labor law so that workers can have more rights. What are our companies doing? Our companies are saying that they won't go to China if they do that. And so the pressures are making sure that people don't have rights. I think that we need to address the issue of how do we raise up worker standards, not just here, but around our world at the same time. There needs to be some kind of standard about a livable wage, figuring out healthcare that really deals with people around the world. We need to figure out how people are going to retire when they're old and not be in poverty. We need to figure out educational standards. And when we have a global policy and when we have trade policies that deal with some of that, then we can, I think, then the attitude of what's going on in America from seen from afar will be seen differently.
I think that's right. And if I would just could add here, I mean, one of the things that's catching on more in Europe than here is this concept of decent work. And what does decent work look like, not just here but around the world? And it's the kind of principle that fits very well under the umbrella of the common good. Because I think we've got to understand that global trade isn't, in fact, global. Global trade involves a subset of countries and a subset of people within those countries. And just as we are struggling to find enough value paid to our workers for their role in trade or to our small farming families, that's the same issue that other countries are facing. So I think part of our challenge in defining a common good is to think less in terms of another country being our opposition in a trade struggle, and thinking more about where our commonalities are between workers here and workers abroad, farmers here and farmers abroad, in a way that allows us to change the entire system and make great trade truly global rather than what it is now, which is selective in every country in the world.
I think that's an important point, because I think one of the problems with the trade debate in the context of the common good is that we don't talk enough about the effects of this system on the least affluent in the most affluent countries.
Right.
And that what you really have is potentially conflicts of interest across international lines, but also a very deep conflict of interest within our society. And we have not figured out a good way to work out that conflict of interest. Anybody want to take that on? But because I really do want to, but, you know, before we close, it seems to me that there are two things I'd like you all to do. The first is to address this economic question. And maybe I'll throw both questions out and people can just jump in. The economic question that came to mind, I was at a tribute to John Kenneth Galbraith, a kind of academic tribute. And as people were talking, it occurred to me that the New Deal common good tradition was different from state socialism because it actually worried about concentrated economic power in the state, but it was different from a complete laissez-faire capitalism because it was also worried about concentrated economic power in a small number of hands, and that at its best, that tradition has fought both kinds of concentrated power on behalf of the common good. And I do think perhaps the common good is a useful concept in that respect. And then the second question is simply, how can this be something other than a really nice concept that you would imagine Barney singing about? In other words, that it's such a lovely concept. I mean, who is against the common good? I could imagine a few of my libertarian friends just to be stubborn arguing against it, but I imagine they too would say their notion of liberty is actually embodies a common good. So, and Professor Katyal, I want to bring you back into the conversation on either of these the questions, the particular economic question, or how can this concept be given some real content and potentially controversial content?
Let me talk about the latter in just based on my own experience. So the question is, how can a fourth grade educated Yemeni named Salim Hamdan sue the world's most powerful man, President Bush, in the nation's highest court and win? That's something remarkable that happened. And it didn't happen because of me. It happened because of the people I had at my side. And the only way to get those people was to focus on the common good. President Clinton had me do a report for him back in the last administration on how do we get lawyers to do innovative pro bono work. And I went and spent a year surveying best practices at law firms and how do you get them to on board on controversial projects. And I basically used that model to build the Hamdan case. So I went to Perkins Coie, a big law firm in Seattle, and said, I need you to help me with this case. I want to file it in Seattle. Their biggest client happened to be Boeing. This suit was against President Bush and Secretary Rumsfeld. They could have said, what's in it for me? And I could have given them the language of individual rights, but instead I gave them language about the common good, essentially that what's in it for you is what's in it for all of us because we believe in certain core fundamental principles. And that language allowed me to sell this to 40 big law firms, all of which were at our side. A lot of unusual allies, the Judge Advocate General Corps, a bunch of people, retired generals and admirals in the military and the like. If I was just talking about Hamdan's rights specifically, I don't think existing institutions would sign on. So sometimes the common good is working with allies that aren't always your friends. It's not Human Rights Watch and people like that who you know are going to be at your side. It's trying to figure out what are those bridges, what the Reverend was talking about, that you bring people together who don't normally talk to one another, and you try and figure out, well, here is some way to make it work. And common good is undoubtedly an amorphous term, and in some ways, it's going to be subject to manipulation. But in some ways, there's a core basic truth there, and it's one that can be used in practice.
Mike.
Well, in some ways, I'm glad you mentioned the New Deal, because if you look at Europe, in some ways, the New Deal never ended there, in the sense that they have our counterparts, progressives in Europe, who call themselves different things, talk about solidarity. That's the term they often use instead of the common good. And we couldn't use that term here because it sounds too much like an IWW song, I suppose. But I still like it. But that's my labor background. But I think one of the things we have to talk about when we talk about the economy is that altruism is in your self-interest. That, in fact, the minimum wage is not just good for poor workers. You get better work out of people. They will show up more often. They will want to put more into the job and have a stake in the job because this is not a job that they want to leave a month later to get a different badly paid one. Healthcare, national healthcare insurance is in everyone's self-interest because. As we know, this is we spend more on healthcare in this country than they do in Europe and get less out of it. And good schools obviously are in everyone's self-interest because people come out of schools badly educated. They're much more likely to turn to crime, much more likely to be disruptive in all kinds of ways in society, not to get married, not to have kids, not to have good families and everything else. So, that's, we have to bite the bullet on that, I think, and not, very often in politics, people talk about, well, you have to talk about the self-interest of this group and this group and this group. And, Karl Rove famously, has every individual, charted on 5 different demographic and consumer groups and everything else and appeal to them one-on-one as much as possible. But in the end, if we're progressive, we have to, I think, make that sense of solidarity real to people by saying that, in fact, we are dependent on one another. To make a good society, and that's a good thing. In fact, that's the core of religious traditions as well, I think.
Anna?
So I would say, first of all, the best anti-poverty program record is the labor movement. And so if we really wanted to figure out how to address the issue of low-wage workers around the world, restoring the balance of power between people who work for a living and capital would be one way of doing it. And so adopting laws that gave workers a right to have a union free of intimidation would move a great all of us forward, both in this country and if we could figure out a way of having in our trade agreements as well. So that's one. Because the truth is that in the 50s, the person on an assembly line turning one bolt after another bolt after another bolt didn't have an inherently good job. They had a job that was valued because they had a strong movement that could have their job valued. Low-wage jobs are only low-wage jobs because employers pay low wages. If workers had a voice, we could do something about that. We could do something about the low wages that are for the hotel workers or for the people who pick the crops or stock the shelves or drive the trucks. We could do something about that if they had a right to have a union. So I think that there is a clear strategy of, again, restoring workers' rights to have a union free of intimidation in this country that would go a great way in terms of restoring the economic balance in our country. One.
Could I just interrupt you real quick to ask a question? It seems to me you're quite right about what's happened to the enforcement or non-enforcement of labor law. But also, the global economy has changed the bargaining power of the worker on that line. And that it was possible in the 50s to make those bargains that raised wages because the market within the auto industry was largely domestic and we were kind of making deals with ourselves. That is much harder today. It's less true. The service employees, which is why you guys, one reason why you guys have made a lot of progress.
I would say that our problem with our own labor movement was that we didn't work, as the world globalized and corporations globalized, we didn't, and we needed to. If we had done that, then we would have been in a different place, perhaps. But we can do that right now. The truth is, capital has consolidated. There are fewer corporations in this world, and they are all around the world. And if we as a labor movement united with labor movements in other parts of the world, we could take them on together. As an example, who would think that security guards were actually global corporations? But they are. They work for global corporations around the world. We have been organizing Wackenhut, Group 4 FALC, which is now a global corporation. And we are in 11 countries. We're working with other unions in Indonesia, in Australia, in the UK, in Poland, in South America. In a number of different places, we are all organizing in our unions, the same company at the same time, and we are winning. We just won a very ugly, terrible strike in Indonesia where they were killing people. But we think that that's the way of being able to do that. We need to take on the Walmarts of the world, not just here, but around the world, which is what we are doing right now. And I thought it was great that the Chinese labor movement has actually been able to make an inroad in there, but we've been supportive of the unions in New Zealand on the expansion issues. So I believe that our new federation believes that we have to organize the workers who are here, but we also have to partner with unions around the world, that we can only take this on if we do it together, and that when we do it together, that we will be able to raise up all standards. We can't just think about the workers here. We cannot be an island of prosperity in a global world where the waves are, you know, washing people out. We need to do something about it, and I think that a global strategy, which our unions are now doing, can make a difference. But the laws here could help us, and the laws and our trade agreements giving workers rights in other countries could help them too.
To paraphrase a famous man, it depends on the meaning of the word common and how large that concept becomes in a way. Bruce.
Well, first I want to thank Tom for finding the ultimate left-right synthesis on same-sex marriage. Require marriage, but allow people to marry anyone they want. Takes the best of shotgun marriage, same-sex marriage. You're going to have a wonderful... Look, I think that only in this administration would we see the national interest and the common good at odds with fundamental economic principles. The greatest economic theory we've ever had was an expanding middle class. I think it is entirely possible to square this circle, and the way to make this rise above Barneyism is first to demand something in return, make sure that that we're asking something of people, not just promising them things, but also to be very concrete in the most important debate we're going to have over the next quarter century, which is defining a new social contract, because the one we've got now is not going to be with us much longer, and we need to figure out a way to have universal health care, universal retirement savings, universal access to college, and some kind of universal obligation to give something back.
Tom?
Two quick thoughts. The common good is not simply in our, altruism is not simply in our self-interest. I would say it's also in our national security interest, because global economic injustice, I believe, presents one of the most fertile breeding grounds for terrorism. And so when you have 3 billion people living on $2 a day around the world, we have a problem, Houston. At a local level, we have tried to emphasize both process and outcome. We have had a process where we have engaged the public at the county level. What should our priorities be? And so when we have 50% of our budget being the Montgomery County Public Schools, we can say that this is a product of not simply 9 council members getting together, but the public coming in. And so we've been able to really outline, I think, some very concrete common good priorities. And when I get that letter from the taxpayer saying, why are you spending like a drunken sailor? Well, I can also tell them, well, sir, the reason
you're spending like a drunken educator.
Thank you. Well, the reason your home values are going way up is because we've invested in our schools, And people want to move to this county because of our public schools. People want to move to this county because of our quality of life, because we take care of people. They're proud to say that they live in Montgomery County, where we're not only concerned about ourselves and our families, but our community writ large.
Can I just go right at you on that? Because I believe what you say about Montgomery County is absolutely true. The question is, an awful lot of people, when we talk, common good is a nice term, but in part we are trying to vindicate a significant role for government in building public things and saying that there are public goods that government has an obligation to invest in. And it seems to me that one of the problems with that argument is that so many people are skeptical of government's capacity to do that. Montgomery County has the great advantage that it can point to this public school system where I think there is a broad consensus within the county. And so it's not just because there are a bunch of Washington, D.C. liberals that move out there that tax limitation measures fail. It's also because there actually is a powerful shared interest in these public goods. But I don't think that view prevails everywhere, and that view of government is not always justified everywhere. Could you or Bruce or someone talk about that? Because I do think that's a core problem for progressives generally, and I think it's a core problem for the common good idea.
I will readily concede that I believe Montgomery County is an outlier, and having spent a lot of time in the other 23 jurisdictions in the state, I think that that is probably an accurate statement. We're frequently referred to as sort of, oh, that's Berkeley. Maybe it is. And so the challenge lies ahead of educating.
Although Gaithersburg, they don't think they live.
They don't think, well, no, they just opened up a day labor center now, EJ, so.
My wife works up there. I like Gaithersburg.
So I will readily concede that we're very blessed where I live, because there is that, the ethic that believes that government is not the problem. It is indeed can be a catalyst to produce solutions, and we simply have to make the case that government can work, and I'll readily concede that the work lies ahead elsewhere.
Reinventor, do you have a...
Look, I think if you can't show that government can run a two-car funeral, as Bill Clinton used to say, then you can't prove to people that you're advancing the common good, and more important, you may not be advancing the common good. If government isn't doing the things it has to do well, like schools, public safety, expanding opportunity, then why should people sacrifice to expand it?
Professor Gottschall,
there's a long, deep, rich tradition in America since the New Deal of the government doing things well, bureaucratic expertise. And one of the sad things in the past 6 years is the squelching of the experts in the agency, agency after agency, the Defense Department, Foreign Service, Justice Department, career officials are systematically being shut up, and political appointees are running these agencies. One of the hard things for us, and I hope Bruce and John and other people get us back in 2008, but one of the hard things for people who believe in the common good is that some of us are going to have a natural tendency to want to stack it with our own political appointees and eliminate that kind of expertise in the agency that's really focused on the common good writ large, not the common good of the Democratic Party. So there is going to be an ultimate tension in a couple of years, I hope, and one in which I think we need to resuscitate the idea of bureaucratic expertise.
And I think that the progressive movement has fallen playing the same game as the anti-tax, anti-government forces. And so, you know, there's been a whole movement to be anti-tax, anti-government, and make government as least effective as possible, and try to drive it down people's minds. And I think that oftentimes in elections, you see people fighting over how low the tax can be as opposed to what the quality of services need to be. I've actually been pleased by the debate that's been going on about the Tabor initiatives, because I think that people have come to terms with how to talk about public services and good public services that are good for our communities, good for our children, and good for our future. And so I think that the reason that we've been able to kick off the ballot in a number of states and defeat the initiatives in some states and even turn it around in Colorado was because we're starting to find our voice to talk about how public service and government is a good thing, not a bad thing. And I think that the more that we can put it in the terms of how it's good for our society, how it's good for our children, how it's good for our communities, and tie it back into things like clean water, good roads, good schools, safe communities, that it will resonate in a way that we have not made it resonate before.
I'm going to ask Mike to say a final word. We've got about a minute left. And I just want to throw out two quotations from John Kennedy's 1960 inaugural speech, which I think are actually good common good quotations. The one we all remember is, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. But it's also, my fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America can do for you, but together what we can do for the freedom of man. And the one that's totally forgotten that I love is, if we cannot help the many who are poor, we cannot hope to save the few who are rich. We did have a common good politics in embryo, if you will, or maybe in practice at the beginning of the 60s. The New Left, which you were part of and were a member of, at its best came out of that common good tradition. Can you give us a rigorous but hopeful analysis of the role of this concept in our history, and do it in a few minutes? Oh, I'm told we've got more time, is that right? That couldn't possibly be because our guest speaker is a little late, could it? That never, never happens. Roll on, Reverend Kazin.
I thought it was 10 seconds, so I was thinking of how I could tell a joke that was politically meaningful. You want me to talk about the role of the common good in our history?
Yeah, but in particular, the 15 minutes. Strom Thurmond, I think, holds the filibuster record. Or it was somebody else broke it, I think. But in particular, it strikes me that at the beginning of the 60s, when you go back and read the Port Huron statement, the founding document of SDS, you know, we now think of the New Left in terms of what happened at the end of the 60s and the alienation and the violence and the anger over Vietnam. But when the whole movement started, it was much more a radically democratic movement, built on the concept of participatory democracy. That whole document, the Port Huron Statement, is shot full of common good sort of language. And then we took a detour. And so I want, maybe what I'm really asking you to do is describe the detour and be a map quest for how we find our way from here, assuming you can get there from here.
Well, I mean, part of the dialogue we're having today, EJ, I think, is about how to retain the best of, the individualized 60s, if you will, with the best of the early, common good 60s. And I think that, there's, as I said before, there's no way to separate those two, because they're both human longings, for freedom and for community. And one of the lines of the Port Huron statement was, people have the right to make the decisions that affect their lives. And that's a very pregnant statement, of course, because who are the people? And which decisions are affecting their lives, and how to affect them.
So, I mean, the Cato Institute could use that as a model, as a motto as well.
But it's a model for mass democracy. But of course, the great thing, the problem with mass democracy for some people is that you don't know how it's going to turn out either. You can't say, if the people really had their voice, they would be in favor of all the things we're in favor of. Well, maybe, maybe not. How to get back? I mean, I think, as I said before, I think, Anna is, comes out of the Service Employees Union. And here one of the big, at Georgetown, one of the big things that students do is they work in the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. And the whole idea of service is something which I think should be part of the common good, probably is already. Bruce talked about social responsibility, some sort of national responsibility that young people would have, not in the military necessarily at all, of course, in civilian life. I think, those longings that young people especially have, but really all Americans have, for both, to live free as individuals and to be part of a family, a community, which is striving for something better and a better society, is something that all social movements have within it. And I think to the degree that we're talking about a politics based on those yearnings is something that the 60s was about at its best. But I don't think you can do it without social movements either. I mean, we're talking here, I mean, everybody here is, we're well-dressed and we have various positions fairly high up in whatever institution we're in. But the key thing clearly is to democratize this vision, that we're talking about. So that it's not just something that think tanks in Washington talk about, but it's something that infuses what people do every day. And that's where a term like service is very important. People in the New Left, people in the Black Freedom Movement thought, people in the anti-war movement too, like me, thought we were doing a service for humanity and doing what we're doing. And that spirit has to be alive again. And I think that's part of the far-seeing politicians are part of that problem, but part of it is also, you know, folks in every place that they live, you know, awakening that sense of vision. And there's no other way around it.
Amen. Gail, that means all of you, by the way.
I mean, I think we got to look to the 60s and certainly our history, but as somebody who was young enough that I couldn't stay out late enough to protest and old enough that I remember enough that I hanker for it, what keeps me up at night is thinking about the future. Because I think we're going to wake up in 10 years and find out that the Left Behind series is about the United States. And to get to your first or your two questions a little bit ago about Barney, might be good to get Barney singing about the common good. But the way to give some legs to that, I think, is to combine imagination and real policies in the way that you're talking about, so that it's not just a concept, it's a tangible idea and practice that people can touch and feel. And just to give you an example that goes to your other question on the trade and the economics. If you look at where we are in one of the biggest trade debates of our time, which is the multilateral trade talks on what's called the Doha Development Round, those talks have collapsed entirely over an issue of agricultural subsidies, what we pay mostly our farming businesses as opposed to our farming families, and what effect that has on the poor globally. And there are three ways we can look at that problem. One is the kind of status quo of let's push as hard as we can and get as much as we can for the United States, which I don't think we can do, but it seems to be the course we're on. The second is, and what often comes from some of the left, is to say that trade is inherently evil and unfair, so we just shouldn't do it, which is also untenable. But the third is to think out of the box and into the future and look at things like that as an opportunity, quite frankly, to reorganize the world, to reorganize global agriculture, which the majority of the world's poor people depend on. And by the way, farming families who are under enormous pressure in the United States also depend on. And look at how we reorganize it. Now, the beauty of thinking that way, we're working on something where our proposal is that you're reorganizing it by turning agriculture to biofuels. The point is that the beauty of the common good, if you put it into practice, is something that pays returns. It gets to your point that altruism can be in your self-interest. But only when we put our imaginations together and flesh out the bones are we going to be able to get beyond people thinking this is a nice slogan fits on a bumper sticker, but it means something to my life and I can actually practice it.
Well, first, given the average progressive slogan, it's actually progress that it fits on a bumper sticker. So that's not a terrible thing. I just want to close. We're about to shift to the venue. In the last year, the two columns I wrote that may have been emailed around the most, one about a year ago ran under the headline, The End of the Bush Era. The second ran under the headline, The End of the Right. Now, I'd like to claim that these comms were emailed all over the place because they were eloquent, brilliant, prophetic. In fact, there were just a whole lot of people who devoutly wished that those headlines were true. But I do believe that there is an opening at this moment for creative thinking. I think, and I've talked to conservative friends about this, who see this moment as similar to their moment back in the 60s and 70s when they were building a new conservative movement, and when it was liberalism who seemed to its critics to be out of ideas, exhausted, and arrogant. And I think that we will deeply regret it if we do not seize this moment for both policy creativity, organizational creativity, and intellectual creativity. And I just want to thank this excellent panel for helping us begin some of that work today. But it's going to be up to all of you to carry it out. Thank you all very much for coming today.
Thank you.
We need another word for class, also.
Thanks, y'all. That was really great.
Thank you,
EJ, and the rest of the panelists for a very enlightening and provocative discussion, and thanks for your flexibility as well. One quick note I forgot to mention up front. Unfortunately, one of our panelists who was scheduled to appear, Dr. Bernice Powell Jackson, had an emergency health issue. We wish her well for a speedy recovery, and we thank Reverend Jen for taking her place at the last minute. We're going to take a little bit of a break here to reset the stage and then have President Clinton's address. Thanks again to the panelists. Really enjoyed the discussion.